Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in the United States against Yuji. Smith, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case comes here on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. The question presented involves the enforceability of an Internal Revenue Service summons. The question before the Court is whether the Internal Revenue Service has the statutory authority to issue a summons requiring a person to appear and execute handwriting exemplars in aid of an administrative investigation to determine his correct tax liability. The facts are relatively simple and undisputed, and I can summarize them quickly as follows. In October 1977, Special Agent Patrick Finnessy was assigned to investigate Respondent Yugi's tax liability for the period 1973 through 1976. This period came to the attention of the Internal Revenue Service because the respondent had filed no tax returns for any of these years, and he had sought no extensions for the filing of these returns. The case had been referred to the Intelligence Division by the Audit and Collection Division after it had been determined that no tax returns were filed. The special agent determined to compute the respondent's tax liability by means of the bank deposits method. So the scrutiny focused on respondents' bank accounts. A respondent had two bank accounts in his own name, but the investigation revealed that there were 20 other bank accounts, the bank statements of which were sent to post office boxes in respondents' names. These bank accounts were in other names. And there were signature cards on file with these 20 different bank accounts that bore addresses of properties owned by the respondent. And moreover, there were frequent transfers between these bank accounts. These facts suggested to the agent that respondent was maintaining bank accounts under aliases to conceal taxable income. The amounts were substantial. For 1975, these 20 different bank accounts had an aggregate balance of approximately $50,000, and for 76, it was something like $30,000. Special agent served a summons on respondent requiring to appear and execute handwriting exemplars of the various signatures on these bank accounts so that he could take these handwriting exemplars and submit them for handwriting analysis by an Internal Revenue Service handwriting laboratory. Respondent stated,
Mr. Smith, Mr. Yuji is here on an informal proffer's basis, isn't he?
That seems to be correct, yes, because the briefs, I think, were printed at the expense of the court. After respondents told the agent at the time that he wouldn't comply with the summons, so the United States and the special agent commenced this summons enforcement proceeding in the district court. The district court held a hearing, the transcript of which is set forth in the appendix. And briefly, the special agent testified as to the nature of the investigation, the purpose of the investigation, the necessity, the relevancy and the necessity for the handwriting exemplars, and he also testified that he had made no recommendation with respect to any criminal prosecution of respondent. There's no question in this case that the handwriting exemplars are relevant and necessary to the completion of the service's investigation. The district court then ordered the summons enforced and ordered respondent to provide exemplars of eight different signatures, eight different signatures written out 10 times each. In fact, there's a particular form that the service has for this purpose. The Court of Appeals heard the case en banc and reconsidered and thereafter overruled its prior decision in United States versus Campbell. That was a 2-1 panel decision which had upheld the service's statutory right to statutory authority to require the execution of these handwriting exemplars. The opinions below are brief because the majority simply says we overrule Campbell and adopt the dissenting opinion in Campbell, and the dissent simply says I would follow Campbell. The dissenting opinion of in Campbell is itself brief. What it says is that it views the handwriting process of requiring a handwriting exemplar as a search and seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment, and the dissenting judge went on in that case to say that those charged with investigation and prosecutorial duties should not be the sole judges of when to utilize what he called constitutionally sensitive means in pursuing their tasks. There are two statutes involved in this case. We submit that the Court of Appeals erred and that there is statutory authority to require the execution of his handwriting exemplars. The statutes are set forth in our appendix to our brief at page 1A and 2A in the back of our brief. Section 7601 is the so-called canvas power of the Internal Revenue Service, which the Court has explored in many, many different decisions, most recently in the LaSalle National Bank and also in the John Doe summons case of several terms ago, United States versus Bisseglia. And this sort of charges the Secretary of the Treasury and his delegate, the Commissioner, to cause officers to proceed throughout each district and inquire after and concerning all persons therein who may be liable to pay any internal revenues tax. Section 7602, the immediately succeeding section, is the summons authority. I would direct the Court's attention to subparagraph 2 of that, which gives the Secretary as delegate the authority to summon the person liable for tax, and if I can just move over to page 2A, to appear before the Secretary or his delegate at a time and place named in the summons, and to produce such books, papers, records, and other data, and to give such testimony under oath as may be relevant or material to such inquiry. And the third subparagraph empowers the officer of the Internal Revenue Service to take such testimony of the person concerned. We believe that the compulsory process authority set forth in the statute to require a person to appear and to give such testimony as may be relevant reasonably carries with it the statutory authority to compel a witness to exhibit certain specific physical characteristics, such as handwriting or voice exemplars. This proposition, we think, has been well established not only by decisions of this Court, but by the pertinent authorities.
What you're arguing is basically a statutory question, isn't it?
Yes.
Certainly O'Meara and Dionisio established that if Congress says so, there's no constitutional objection.
Exactly. And I think that Mara and Dionisio, to the extent are relevant here, really refute the dissenting judge in Campbell's view that there was some kind of constitutionally sensitive thing, either from a Fifth Amendment point of view or a Fourth Amendment point of view. I mean, I think it's established that this is not testimonial compulsion, and that it's also established that that requiring someone to give a voice exemplar, show his face, give fingerprints or whatever is not a search and seizure within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. So I don't think there's any constitutional question.
Mr. Smith, is your argument then, you're not arguing that the handwriting exemplar is testimony. In fact, I guess it's not testimony under the
law. No, what we're arguing...
Having given the power to take testimony...
Testimony, right, exactly. Given the statutory power to take testimony of a non-privileged nature, since these non-testimonial acts are non-privileged as established by decisions of this Court, that statutory authority is reasonably inherent in the authority to compel somebody to appear. Because if you can compel somebody to appear before a revenue agent, and for purpose, and let's say the revenue agent, let's say in this particular case, or take the case of Bisseglia, where somebody had made a large deposit to a bank, and the service had a teller who thought that he could identify the person, and there was a suspicion that it was the person under investigation. If he were brought in, quote, to appear, the revenue agent could say to the teller, is this the fellow who deposited the $400, $100 bills or whatever? It's that exhibition of his face, which is inherent in the statutory authority to compel somebody to appear.
You don't really claim, then, that the literal wording of the statute covers this case?
No, I don't think there's any question that the literal wording doesn't cover this case, but we think that given the recent decisional law construing the statutory authority in a broad way to enhance the service's power to find out information and to discharge its canvas duty to go around and to find out who owes tax, that this is a reasonable construction of the statute, and it doesn't offend any constitutional concerns, and there really is no policy reason to construe the statute in any other way. I think, for example, I think one of the things that I think is germane is the court observed in Bisseglia that had the taxpayer or the bank official in that case been called before a grand jury, there wouldn't be any question that the grand jury could compel the bank official to answer questions. And then the court analogized the service summons authority to the grand jury authority to seek information. We don't think that there really is that. We think that analogy, coupled with the statutory language, which we think is hospitable to our construction, more or less carries the day and demonstrates the error of the court below. Because here again, had the respondent been called before a grand jury, there's no question that he would have to make these handwriting exemplars. And the protections, one of the arguments that's made is, well, you know, he doesn't have any protections in this case. Somehow there's this is being decided by an internal revenue officer that he has to do this and that he doesn't have any protections of a neutral officer. But I think it's well established that the whole summons enforcement mechanism is replete with protections, not only of a statutory nature, but the protections established by the decisions of this court, decisions like Donaldson and Powell, which more or less indicate that that more or less say without any question that that a summons of the Internal Revenue Service is not self-executing, that a person can object to its enforcement, as indeed respondent did in this case, and that you have the interposition of the federal judiciary to determine whether the summons is overbroad, and a variety of questions which courts determine every day. In fact, you have a full adversary proceeding which enables the person to object to particular questions. You have the right to, in fact, you have the right to appear with counsel when you go to comply with the summons, which you don't have in the grand jury. I think, you know, it more or less demonstrates to us the truth of the court's observation in Bisseglia that Congress has provided protection from arbitrary or capricious action by placing the federal courts between the government and the person summoned. So that the analogy between an Internal Revenue Service summons and a grand jury subpoena, we think, is sound and provides all the necessary, and the decisions of this court provide all the necessary protections in this case. We don't really see that there's any real problem either from a constitutional or from a statutory nature with construing the statute in a way to provide giving these handwriting exemplars. May I simply address another point of objection which we think is really without force is the fact that the court below felt somehow that the service had no authority to force somebody to create things. In other words, that somehow you can get a piece of paper or, you know, books and records, but you can't say to somebody, you know, okay, come in and create something for us. But, I mean, it seems to us there really are two answers to that. You're not really asking anybody to create something when you ask them to provide handwriting exemplars. All you're really doing is asking them to display a physical characteristic, much the same way that when you take someone's photograph, you're not creating their face, or if you record their fingerprints, you're not creating their fingerprints. All you're doing is recording a physical characteristic.
Mr. Smith, does this statute authorize taking fingerprints?
I would think it would, Mr. Justice Stevens.
Blood samples?
What?
About blood samples, voice exemplars.
I would think it would also. I would think that it would, you know, the whole gamut of non-testimonial disclosures, like asking somebody to put on a hat or, you know, these things are normally not done in past investigations.
Is this power used in connection with preparation of criminal cases or just civil cases?
The summons authority power?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, at this stage, I think the decisions of this court indicate that the civil and criminal aspects of the case are intertwined. I mean, so I don't think that I can answer that question and say that a criminal case is being prepared here. I think that what the, you know, in fact, there may be nothing. In other words, just like the $400, $100 bills in Bisseglia might have turned out to be an innocent thing, and in fact, to go off the record, they were innocent.
If these exemplars showed that it was the same person who signed his name on all these accounts, be pretty clearly criminal liability, wouldn't it?
Assuming that the balances that went into the accounts were represented unreported taxable income, they all could have been inheritances from his grandmother. Again, this is really an attempt to ferret out information in order to determine what the scope of the liability is here.
And if that was his signature, the only thing left for him to do is plead guilty.
It
would be a real waste of time to try him, wouldn't it?
Well, it's possible that he could then say that his an elderly aunt left him all of this money. I mean, I think that the question would be fairly put to him as to where this money came from. But the point is, again, you're right, Mr. Justice Marshall, that if these were demonstrated to be his signatures, I think that he would have an obligation to explain why he felt the need to maintain 20 different bank accounts with false names. That's not the normal kind of thing that people do.
Is there any federal statute we'll start with federal. Any federal statute that prevents you or me or anyone from having 10 bank accounts in 10 different names, which trade names?
I don't think there's any federal prohibition, but I suspect that he probably ran the gamut here and used false Social Security numbers. And, you know, I suspect at that point that probably, because you do have an obligation, I think, to give your bank an appropriate, you know, the correct Social Security number so that they could report.
Is that by federal statute?
Well, most people only have one Social Security number, don't they?
Right, that's right. Exactly. And in fact, if I may just pursue this for a moment, that really goes to one of the things we mentioned in our brief one of the really prime necessity for this kind of summons. Apparently, it's become quite common for people to file multiple tax returns asking for refunds. And there is now a program in the service called the Questionable Return Program, which is designed to determine who these people are. Apparently, as of 1976, the service had determined that some 8,900 returns were questionable returns and sought refunds in the aggregate of $12.3 million. So, and then, of course, there's a whole host of, I mean, the imagination, it's only limited by one's imagination to think of the number of instances in which document authentication is an important part of an Internal Revenue Service inquiry.
The service has a real problem, doesn't it? In the case of kids going to college and working for the summer, whose wages are withheld during the time they work, but they don't work a long enough period to be required to pay any tax. And so there are just, literally thousands of legitimate.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, my recollection is that several years ago, and it certainly came long after I worked for the summer, that you could file a particular form and absolve yourself of withholding if you could demonstrate, on the assertion, on the assurance that you that we're not going to have taxable income in excess of a certain amount, so that you wouldn't have this over withholding.
My kids have been doing an awful lot of paperwork. If you're right.
They need better tax advice.
But it is, I take it from your response to my earlier question, that there is no statute which forbids any person from having 10 different bank accounts in 10 different names.
I'm not aware of any statutory prohibition, but of course there is a statutory prohibition against concealing taxable income and not reporting.
Well, that's not my question.
Yes.
My question is, prompted by Mr. Justice Marshall's point, that revealing that you had 10 different bank accounts under 10 different names is not automatically an admission of any guilt.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But
you might do that to, so that your children...
Well, no. All it does in this case is to... I think that all I'm saying in this case is that these facts reasonably suggested to the Internal Revenue Service that there might be a problem here with this respondent. I mean, all that goes to is the legitimacy of this investigation. This wasn't a research project,
maybe
but
it wasn't a plea of guilty, but at least it was a prima facie net worth case, wasn't it?
I think it certainly would enhance, it would bring the service, as Mr. Justice Blackmun said, to first base, I suppose. Okay.
Perhaps he might come in and explain that he just didn't want his wife and his children to know how much money he had in the bank.
A common sense.
They'd spend it all.
Yes, indeed, and in fact, but of course he hadn't filed any tax returns at all, so it's possible he didn't want the Internal Revenue Service to know how much money he had earned. He was a tax return preparer. He's not the kind of person who's innocent of learning in these matters.
And he's here IFP.
And he's here IFT. I cannot explain that. But even if I'm getting back to this business about creating materials, even apart from the question, I don't think that, displaying a physical characteristic is a creation of any evidence, but rather a recordation of something that really exists. There also is settled authority. That's Section 7602, the summons enforcement authority, includes the right to have the service summon client lists of tax return preparers, without regard to whether they were in existence or not. Those cases are firmly established in the circuits and, in fact, were cited with approval by this court in Biseglia at page 148 of the opinion. So here, I think that the concerns of the court, the constitutional concerns, are groundless, and the statutory concerns, I think, from a matter of sort of textual analysis of the statute, as well as policy concerns, are groundless. The respondent here has sufficient protections to be able to narrow the scope of the summons, or a respondent. And
Mr. Smith, I know you discussed in your brief, but I just don't remember. How old is this problem? How long has this problem been a matter of debate between taxpayers?
Well, problem in the litigation apparently just began to surface about 4 or 5 years ago when people began to object. There's been some voluntary compliance, and I asked the Internal Revenue Service how long they had been getting handwriting exemplars, and they have a standard form. I was told that the Treasury Department had been requiring this information as early as 1921. From 1921 until 1973, the handwriting analysis was done by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Tax Branch of the IRS, which I think now has been moved to the Justice Department. But
is the service practice since 1921 something they've been requiring or just requesting?
No, that they've been requesting where cases appropriate to
have
request.
Have there been enforcement proceedings, since then?
I'm not aware of any litigation or enforcement proceedings until the mid-1970s when this started to become a problem. And in fact, the only cases of appellate rank are Campbell, this case, Brzezinski, I think there's one other Fourth Circuit case that sort of created the conflict, but we think that this the decisions of this court lend support to our submission that the statute embraces these non-testimonial disclosures, since there's no constitutional or policy reason
to read the statute in a way which is inhospitable with this with these purposes. We submit that the judgment of the Court of Appeals is wrong and should be reversed. There are no further questions.
I have a question, Mr. Smith. I take it from your argument that you're making neither pro nor con out of the change in the one word data to the one word memorandum or vice versa in the 39 to the present code.
We think that the words other data further support our submission that the statute covers these kinds of exemplars. But I think that the stronger argument is that the service has the authority to make someone come and appear. I think that the Sixth Circuit in Brown misread the legislative history in two different ways, which we discuss in our brief. It misread it by suggesting that the word other data was added to a transferee liability provision, and in fact it was not. And then it also, we think, narrowly focused on simply one of the three legs of the antecedents of Section 7602 and made something about the fact that, you know, memoranda became other data, so that other data must necessarily mean memoranda. But it seems to us that the words books, papers, etc., more or less would cover memoranda, and that other data is a word of general import that would cover information of any kind.
It would be harder to say that exemplars are memoranda than it is to say that they are data.
Exactly. I think that's right.
The dictionary meaning of data?
We set it forth in our brief. It's detailed information of any kind or material for an investigation. It certainly, I think, would fit, you know, any kind of constitutionally permissible evidence, like handwriting exemplars or voice exemplars. May I simply say one thing in pursuing your, may I make a correction in our brief, which I just discovered this morning, that the footnote on page 36, footnote 7, which cites a Senate report in the second paragraph, Senate reports number 558, 73rd Congress, second sess, it says 623, and that should be
48-49. That isn't much of a mistake.
No.
It's fairly minor.
But it'd be hard to find. I have nothing further to add if there are no questions. Thank you.
Mr. Irwin.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My name is James Irwin, counsel for the respondent, Harvey F. Ugee. The issue in this case is whether Congress has authorized the use of an administrative summons to compel the creation of physical or real evidence, in this particular case, handwriting exemplars, in the administrative investigation of tax liability. We submit that there is nothing in the text of the statute, in its legislative history, or in the antecedents of the statute to which legislative history makes reference, which supports that view. The government relies upon two words or phrases that appear in the statute, the first of which is appear, the power to compel a person to appear and give testimony, or to compel a person to appear and produce books, papers, records, and other data. We believe that the word appear merely has reference to compelling a person to respond to the summons. This is in accord with the purpose of the statute. The agent who issues the summons is conducting a tax investigation. Therefore, there is no such thing as a default in the ordinary case for monetary or equitable relief. He needs to have a response. The person must either comply with the summons or he must appear and make whatever good faith defense he may have to it. This was the statutory structure is likewise set up in this way. Section 7604B, to which this Court had reference in the Kaplan case in 1964, noted that it was only for use where a person wholly defaulted or contumaciously refused to comply with the summons. And in fact, this is a procedure that was followed in this case in the district court. Mr. Ugee initially failed to appear before the revenue agent in response to the summons, and he initially failed to appear before the district court in response to an order to show cause. an attachment for his arrest was issued under Section 7604B, and he was brought before the court, and the case eventually proceeded to a hearing. And incidentally, at the time he was brought before the court, there was a hearing held on his financial ability to retain counsel.
You say there was a hearing?
Yes, there was. It's not included in the appendix, but there is a transcript of it that was included in the record in the Court of Appeals.
How much is involved in these side accounts?
Pardon me?
How much money is in the side accounts?
The agent testified at the hearing that he had determined that in the year 1975, $30,000 had passed through the account. In 1976, $50,000.
He couldn't afford counsel?
Well, Your Honor, this was at a time, about two years before the time of the hearing on the financial condition.
Well, maybe there's $60,000 in there now.
I don't know.
That's just as inferable as that there isn't anything in them at this point.
What was his testimony as to his net worth at the time?
He did not testify.
And the court nonetheless allowed him to proceed IFP?
Well, he testified that his assets were tied up in real estate, which were subject to foreclosure in proceedings by the Redevelopment Authority in St. Louis for failure to pay city taxes.
Are you, as a member of the bar, satisfied that he fulfills the IFP standard?
Yes, I am, sir. I think it is further significant that the statute does not use the broadest possible language that it could in setting forth the scope of the summons. For example, it does not say that a person could be compelled to appear and give evidence of any kind. Evidence, of course, includes not only testimony, oral statements under oath, or the production of documentary evidence, books, papers, and records, but also real and physical evidence, handwriting exemplars, fingerprints, summaries, charts, many things that can be used as evidence in a trial.
Would you agree, as suggested by your brother, that he could be summoned to appear for the purpose of having his picture taken?
No, Your Honor.
You don't?
Do not agree.
He could be summoned to appear and bring with him an existing picture.
Yes.
I mean, you can see that.
I believe this is the point in which the statute addresses itself, that could be compelled to produce documents or evidence of a documentary nature that does exist. A picture would be an example of that type.
Your response to that is within the framework of the tax code, I take it?
Yes.
Not generally?
No, not generally. I think a grand jury or a court has inherent power to compel the production of evidence which the Internal Revenue Service does not have. The Internal Revenue Service power is statutory. It has only that power which has been given to it.
Well, if he's ordered to produce an exemplar in the proceeding by the district court, where does the compulsion originate? You say it is not the court acting?
Yes, the court is acting, but it is acting pursuant to the statute. There is a jurisdictional statute which is worded in the same words as the scope of the summons power, Section 7402B and also Section 7604A, confer jurisdiction upon the district court to enforce a summons for the production of books, papers, records, and other data.
But the district court would have no more power to enforce the summons than the service had to issue the summons.
That's correct.
And then why do you say that the district court could do something that the service couldn't do?
Okay, the district court in a pending criminal case pursuant to a motion of the government could order the execution of a handwriting exemplar, or it could order the enforcement of a grand jury subpoena for a handwriting exemplar.
But that doesn't depend on the Internal Revenue Code.
No, it does not. But its power in this particular type of case does depend upon the Internal Revenue Code.
And we're dealing here specifically with the provisions of Section 7602, are we not?
Yes, sir.
Then do I understand you that if Congress had provided in that section that the Internal Revenue Service could require the production of handwriting exemplars, you would not be here?
That's correct.
Mr. Irwin, I know the government doesn't argue this, but have you considered whether the, by analogy, the New York telephone case, whether the All Writs Act would give the court the power to, in aid of the jurisdiction, it's a jurisdiction to order production of this kind of material?
No, sir, I have not considered that. The other portion of the statute, which the government makes reference in their brief, is that part which states that the Internal Revenue Service has the power to summon books, papers, records, and other data. The legislative history of this statute is very simple. It consists of one sentence, and it states that the section was not intended, or was intended to enact no material change from existing law. Existing law in 1954, of course, was the 1939 Internal Revenue Code, which was itself a codification of previous Internal Revenue Acts. The three statutes which set forth the scope of the summons in the 1939 Code are Section 3614, Section 3615, and Section 3654. Section 3614A refers to the examination of books, papers, records, or memoranda. Section 3615A refers to summons for the production of books. And Section 3654A refers to examination of books, papers, accounts, and premises, and the summoning of books and papers.
Mr. Irwin, supposing that under Section 7602, the last sentence of it, and to give such testimony under oath as to, before the Secretary or his delegate at a time and place named in the summons, and to produce such books, papers, records, or other data, and to give such testimony under oath as may be relevant or material to such inquiry. And the Secretary's delegate decides it would be very helpful to us and material and relevant for us to have a statement from you of your net worth on January 1st and your net worth on December 31st. And the man responds, I don't have any such thing in existence. Do you think the Secretary could say, well, give us your best estimate?
Well, I believe that in that situation, a person would have a Fifth Amendment privilege to refuse to respond.
I don't doubt it for a minute if he came within the Fifth Amendment. But do you think it is not authorized by statute?
Well, the taking of testimony from the taxpayer is authorized by statute. Testimony,
so you
I take it to mean oral statements under oath, and the statute specifically authorizes that in subsection 3.
Well, but what they're asking for him here is to write it out.
Well, I don't believe the statute authorizes them to compel the creation of a document.
You say that he could be asked what his net worth was on January 1st and on December 31st, but he could not be asked to write out what his net worth was on January 1st and December 31st.
That is our position. However, they could summon documents which would reflect that.
Let's make it even more simple. Let's forget about net worth. Suppose he came in, put him under oath, and asked his name, and he said, whatever it is, UG. And well, he said, let's have you write it out. Would that be proper on the part of the service?
I think not, Your Honor, if it's for the purpose of a handwriting exemplar. I might point out that in this particular case, there are
the
handwriting
exemplars. Doesn't speak of oral testimony.
Well, the testimony under oath, I think, refers to oral testimony.
It does?
In the production of evidence, production of documentary-type evidence, books, papers, records.
On the same line, supposing they asked him for a list of his receipts by month for the past 12 months, and a list of his expenditures, and a profit and loss statement, and a balance sheet, none of which he'd prepared, could they say, well, you could tell us all this orally, we'd like you to prepare it in writing so it's much more manageable for us?
I think not, Your Honor. I think they could not be compelled to produce or create those documents affirmatively by the service, and that at least until the mid-1970s, I believe the service itself recognized that. We cited in our brief some administrative regulations where they stated that a person was not to be required to produce summaries or lists, that was a job for the agent based upon the testimony that he may have taken or the documents that have been produced.
What if he said in response to the same question that we've been talking about, it's all on a data processing system in my office, and I just don't have any recollection of it. And the people in the service say, well, we have no way of getting into your data processing machine. Would you just write out the summary of the net worth or name or whatever it is as of January 1st and as of December 31st?
Well, again, I do not think they could be compelled to create that document. Now, if it exists on a computer tape, the Second Circuit in the United States versus Davey has said that a computer tape which contains those types of records is other data under the statute. So that is in existence. It may not
compel the retrieval of raw data in the computer.
Well, the Davey case involved the production of the actual tape itself rather than the retrieval of the data. I think most persons would rather retrieve the data voluntarily than turn over the tape if that's the only record they have. But
that wasn't my question. I'm asking whether he could be compelled to produce the or to retrieve the raw data.
Well, I think this is a transformation of existing information that is capable, that does exist, is an existing record and cannot be read by human beings, of course.
So
but
the answer
it must
is
be
yes.
Transformed into a printout in order to be read by persons. Getting back to the 1939 code, I think it is also significant that the code in the provision relating to the jurisdiction of the district court to enforce a summons states that the district court has the power to enforce a summons to produce books, papers, or other data. This is the very phrase that occurs in Section 7602. This phrase was inserted in the code in the jurisdictional portion of the tax code in 1919. The Internal Revenue Act was enacted then. It was subsequently reenacted several times through 1939, appears in Section 3633A of the 1939 code, and is presently Section 7402B of the 1954 code. I think it is clear from a comparison of the jurisdictional statute with those statutes which set forth the scope of the summons under the 1939 code and prior internal revenue laws, that other data is a catch-all term that refers to items of like kind and nature as set forth. It does not specify records or memoranda or accounts which are set forth in the scope of the summons power.
Mr. Irwin, I wanted to ask you about the Basaglia case. Do you feel there are no implications in that decision that are adverse to your position here? You cited only twice, once to the dissenting opinion and once to the ensuing curative legislation.
Yes. Well, there is a suggestion that the grand jury analogy, which is Mr. Smith has made reference to, is complete in this type of case, that the Congress intended to give to the Internal Revenue agent the same power that a grand jury has. I believe that that is not correct, that the grand jury and the Internal Revenue agent stand on a different footing, and while the analogy does have force in certain situations, it does not have force in this particular situation. First of all, a grand jury is, as was pointed out in the dissenting opinion in that case, a creature of the Constitution. The Internal Revenue Service is a statutory body. It does not have inherent power, as a grand jury does, to compel the production of all types of evidence.
Do you think that if Congress abolished grand juries, that law would be unconstitutional?
Yes, I think it would.
The Constitution assures every defendant in a federal criminal case that he can't be tried unless he's indicted by a grand jury, doesn't it?
I believe it does in those, practically those very words, Your Honor. And I believe that, therefore, it could not be abolished. There may be restrictions placed on it, but...
So maybe it wouldn't be unconstitutional, but nobody could be tried in a federal criminal court.
Right. And the functions of a grand jury are not the same as the special agent's functions, as the agent of the Internal Revenue Service. There is a similarity in that both of them...
You're saying that somehow the guarantee of the Justice Stewart is commented upon the right of every person to be indicted by a grand jury constitutionalizes the right of the grand jury in a way that favors the government over an act of Congress which authorizes the service to do something. Now, is that what you mean?
Well, what I am saying is that the grand jury has inherent power, such as a court does in a pending criminal case, to order the production of this type of evidence, as contrasted to the power of the Internal Revenue Service, which is statutory. And if the statute does not provide for that power, no matter how much they would like to have it or might need it, they do not have it. And that is the point I'm trying to make, sir. I'd further point out that the grand jury has two functions, historically. One is the investigative function, which the agent of the Internal Revenue Service also has. The other is to function as a protection of citizens from the prosecutorial arm of the government. This is not something that's shared by the agent of the Internal Revenue Service. True, the Internal Revenue Service does not actually prosecute the case that comes to trial, but certainly they are aligned with the prosecution. They investigate and prepare the case and make recommendations. Frequently, agents or other employees of the Internal Revenue Service participate in grand jury proceedings for technical assistance, and they frequently provide expert witnesses at a criminal trial. Finally, there is no neutral supervision of the issuance of a summons prior to its issuance, except in very limited cases as set forth in Section 7609. There is supervision if the taxpayer objects, in which case it goes to the district court and the matter is reviewed. It appears that this does not occur very often. Taking the government statistics from their brief in the 18-month period ending in December of 78, they said that handwriting exemplars were used in 320 cases. Our research has turned up only about 10 cases, reported and unreported, in which the use of a summons was reviewed. So it's less than 5% of the cases have reviewed the use of a summons for handwriting exemplars. This is in a situation where there is enough doubt about whether the Internal Revenue Service even has the power that it has required resolution by this court. It may be that the experience of the Internal Revenue Service is such that it has revealed a need to be able to use an administrative summons to obtain handwriting exemplars or voice exemplars or perhaps in exceptional cases, fingerprints, I believe even blood samples were mentioned. But it's our position that the present statute does not authorize that. It is an old statute that goes back many years. There was an existing practice at the time that this present statute was enacted, a practice that had been existing since the 19th century for the production of documentary evidence, which is the usual type of evidence used in a tax case, whether civil or criminal. It may be that the statute, to that extent, is obsolete and needs changing.
But the Second Circuit held that it applied to computer tapes.
Yes, and because they were presently in existence, and they made reference to the Brown case and said that it only applied to documents which were presently in existence, and agreed with that position of the Brown case, which relied primarily on canons of statutory construction, the justum generis, which is essentially what we have been arguing in this case. But it did not say that they had the power to compel the production of documents or lists or summaries which did not exist at the time the summons was issued. And indeed, I think this case may have implications for third-party summons, which uses the same language as Section 7602 when directed towards a third-party record keeper to require them not just to turn over what records they may have to the Internal Revenue Service, but to prepare lists or summaries or analyses, so forth, that they presently do not have to do. If the service needs the power to compel the execution of handwriting exemplars or to compel the production of other real or physical evidence, we believe that the appropriate forum for addressing that is Congress, which, after all, is the body which has enacted the statute and has given them the power to issue the summons in the first place. It's our position that summons power should not be enlarged by this court under the guise of statutory construction to include within its scope that which Congress has excluded. And the judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Mr. Smith, do you have anything further?
I have nothing further if the court has no questions.
I think not. Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
Your Honor, the court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.